This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Sports are a part of American life, yet there are questions surrounding the safety of some sports, like football. If you're a parent, how do you decide which sports your child can play? Coming up, we'll talk with two parents who have different perspectives on football, and we'll hear from a high school coach about efforts to make the sport safer. In recent years, attention has focused on pro athletes who played in the NFL and who later died unexpectedly or in violent ways. Their families donated the athletes' brains to science, and what researchers found has been disturbing. More than 100 of these former football players had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. A doctor specializing in sports medicine will join us later to explain what researchers know so far about the degenerative brain disease. The latest case of CTE in a former pro football player made headlines when researchers considered the age of the athlete. I'm talking about Connecticut native and one-star tight end for the New England Patriots, Aaron Hernandez. Before he died, he was known as a convicted murderer. Here's Boston University neuropathologist Dr. Ann McKee last month after they released the results of Hernandez's brain autopsy. At 27 years old, he had an advanced stage of CTE.
These are very unusual findings to see in an individual of this age. We've never seen this in our 468 brains. Except in individuals some 20 years older.
Whether you follow football or not, how did you react to this news? Does it make you question watching a sport that can not only break a man's body, but with the amount of physical contact, his brain too? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email where we live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Certainly, CTE has been found in other athletes, boxers, hockey players, but today we're focusing on football. My next guest knows the NFL well. Her husband played in the league for 9 years. She knows about CTE, too. Her husband was the sixth former NFL player to be diagnosed with the disease. From WUSF Studios in Tampa, Lisa McHale joins us now. She's director of family relations at the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your husband was Tom McHale, and he played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. When did you meet him?
I met him in college. We were both undergrads. He was 4 years older than I, but we met going into my sophomore year.
Tell us about him. People have images of what an athlete is, especially someone who's a pro football player who ended up in that career. Tell us about what it was like in college and his personality.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody says their guy's the best, but Tom truly was. You know, he had given up a full scholarship and starting position at University of Maryland in order to attend Cornell's School of Hotel Administration. And so by the time I met him, he already kind of had a reputation on campus. There aren't a lot of, potential NFL prospects playing in the Ivy Leagues, and particularly in his day. So he was well known, and yet he was very admirably humble, really tremendous, engaging, dynamic, and of course very handsome man.
For people who may not follow football, he was an offensive lineman, so he was a big guy.
He was. He was quite large, quite a bit. I'm 5'2 and a half. He was 6'4". And when I met him, 260, by the end of his playing career, he would say one cheesesteak over 300. A couple years in Philadelphia.
He studied at Cornell, as you mentioned. So what were his dreams? He was good enough to make it into the NFL, but that wasn't the end game.
Yeah, I think, you know, Tom was somewhat unique in that he had a lot of aspirations a bit beyond playing in the NFL. And in fact, his reasons for giving up the scholarship were that he knew from a young age that he wanted to own and operate restaurants. And so when he kind of came to the realization in college that he was clearly at Maryland for one thing and one thing only, and that was to play football, and was concerned he wasn't setting himself up for his future beyond the game. So he gave that up to attend the world's really leading school in hotel and restaurant management.
I mentioned earlier he played in the Tampa Bay Buccaneers as offensive lineman for 9 years. Describe that period of your life, Lisa. What was it like when he was in the NFL? You were starting a family. To walk us through that time.
Oh, yeah. Well, just slight correction. He played 6 years for the Bucks, then two for Philadelphia Eagles, and his final season was under Don Shula with the Miami Dolphins in 1995. But not going to lie, it was an exciting life. I was very young when we married, just 23 years of age, and just graduated about 9 months after graduating from Cornell. I moved to Tampa, and we built a home together, and we had a lot of opportunities and that we wouldn't otherwise have. And certainly sitting in a stadium of, 70,000 people and hearing your husband's name announced on the loudspeaker in the starting lineup and being a part of the crowd is an exciting experience.
Was he injured during his career? What kind of injuries did he sustain?
If people would ask him later in his retirement, he would rattle off a lot more than I really thought much about as we were playing, but mostly just broken and disjointed fingers and whatnot. He had been most injured in college, had suffered a shoulder injury that required surgery, but in the pros, his main injury was he had a partial tear of his medial collateral ligament in one of his knees, which did not require surgery. And essentially a groin injury took him out towards the end of his career for quite some time.
When he retired, what was his mindset? Was he sad to leave a sport that he loved?
Again, I think Tom is a bit unique in that he decided after 9 years that, in large part, he was very anxious to get on to the next stage of his life and begin that, his dream of getting into the restaurant industry. He was also, getting more concerned about the physical implications, the way this would impact him later in life, and decided, I've put a lot of wear and tear on my body. I think I'm going to call it quits. And so he actually had some opportunities to go in and play a 10th season, but decided, I'm grateful for the time I had. I'm ready to move on. And actually walked away from the game, which I think is not an easy thing to do. But as far as I could tell, he did it with no regrets at all.
When did you notice his personality changing, Lisa?
It's such a difficult question to answer because, this disease comes on very, very gradually. And, with 20/20 hindsight, you kind of look back and you look at things very differently. And I go back to even, very, very early on and wonder, is it possible that CTE may have impacted him back when? But because I can tell you the easiest way to answer that is that when it became abundantly clear to me that things were very different is really when Tom confided in me that he was extremely depressed and that he had been for quite some time. He complained about the physical pain to me for the first time, said that that just the pain of being on his feet all day, running around the restaurant and, greeting folks and running the restaurant was just becoming too great. And he just wasn't enjoying it all anymore. And it was a very, very scary realization for several reasons. One, because that kind of depression was so contrary to his nature. And two, because he was the sole breadwinner in the family. I was raising three young sons, the oldest of whom had very significant special needs.
I understand that he was prescribed large doses of painkillers. When did you find out that he had an addiction problem?
Yeah, again, kind of gradually, it was toward, he was nearing 40 when he confided that, no, I'm sorry, you know what, that's not correct. But yes, that is correct. It was around 40 that it was brought to my attention that he had become physically dependent on doctor-prescribed opiate medications for his pain. And he had been doing internet research to try to figure out how to wean himself off and get out of this and had just been unsuccessful in doing that. And his behavior became kind of out of control because he had become not just addicted, but was abusing the pills. And it was very obvious now that it was problematic. And so he did go under the treatment of physicians to deal with his addiction.
And what happened, Lisa?
Well, he unfortunately suffered a couple of relapses. You know, the challenge, I think, for Tom, and clearly because of the disease, is that while even when he was removed from the drugs and any kind of substances, he wasn't himself. And it wasn't helping with the depression. It wasn't helping him get back his just spunk for life. And he was clearly aware of that. It was really impacting him. And it just seemed like there was something else going on. We had no idea what that was. But I think because of all of that, I think Tom just in his own mind just couldn't pull himself out. And I think it had to be incredibly disappointing and challenging for him. And ultimately, he suffered he had another relapse and ultimately suffered a accidental fatal overdose.
He was 45?
45 years old.
I'm speaking with Lisa McHale. She's director of family relations at the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Her late husband, Tom McHale, was an offensive lineman in the NFL. He played for several teams. Today she joins us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. We're talking about football in light of all the attention in recent years about CTE, this degenerative brain disease or chronic traumatic encephalopathy. After he passed, Lisa, when did you decide to donate his brain to science?
Well, you know, this kind of a decision is something that needs to be made very, very quickly. And so, you know, as I had said, neither Tom nor I, we had no knowledge of CTE. I had never heard of it. I don't believe he had either. And we would have countless conversations, wondering what is going on and what can I do to help. And, you know, and so it wasn't as though we anticipated this in any way. I just received a call because of the nature of his death and who he was as a former athlete. His death went public. And so it was brought to the attention, I would imagine, of the researchers. And I received a call from Chris Nowinski, who is now CEO of Concussion Legacy Foundation and one of the co-founders of the research center at Boston University. And he called to request my husband's brain for scientific study.
When you donated his brain, were you convinced that the researchers would find something?
I actually ironically told Chris, you know, you're not going to find what you're looking for, because it was, to the best of my knowledge, I never knew Tom to have suffered any concussions. It wasn't a conversation that we ever had. And he had said it was, you know, it had to do with looking at the connection between concussions and later life difficulties. So I was very certain that Tom would be a control subject.
And coming up, we're going to hear from a doctor who specializes in sports medicine about what they know today about what causes CTE. When you found out, Lisa, that your husband had this disease, you were shocked, I'm sure. And then what did you do?
You know, when it was first explained to me that Tom had this disease, CTE, it did not mean a great deal to me because very little was known at the time. I had never heard of it. And I figured, okay, Tom has a rare disease. Okay. But it was in learning that Tom was actually the sixth former NFL player out of six tested that was positive with this very, very rare disease that doesn't exist in the brain unless there is exposure to trauma, that then says something very significantly to me. And so I was asked by the research group if I would go public with Tom's findings. And without hesitation, I said, absolutely, because this is something, clearly there's something significant going on here, and people need to know.
That was back in 2009?
In January of 2009.
Fast forward now to 2017, much more attention on CTE, on the number of former NFL players whose brains have also been donated to science. I think more than 100 have been found to have CTE. What's been your response with how the NFL has changed their views or even how they responded initially and today?
There is no question that the NFL has engaged in this strategy of willful ignorance for as long as they have been able to do so, until I think the numbers of deceased NFL players diagnosed with this disease have become so great that they were, I would say, forced to finally concede what most of us has been obvious for quite some time, that clearly there is a connection between playing football and CTE.
I mentioned earlier you work now for the Concussion Legacy Foundation as Director of Family Relations. What's your role there?
Primarily, I work as the liaison between the research team and all of the families who make this donation to the research center. And we have very strong connections with the families because we rely on them for comprehensive medical and clinical histories on their loved ones that, of course, make the neuropathological findings that much more meaningful.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, again from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Lisa McHale is with us. Her husband, her late husband, Tom McHale, was a former offensive lineman in the NFL. He died from a fatal overdose when she donated his brain to science. He was the sixth former NFL player to be found with this severe brain disease, this degenerative brain disease of CTE. We're going to continue to talk about that after the break. Learn more about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and whether the sport has changed to make it safer for the pros and for young athletes. Do you watch the NFL? Do you allow your children to play football? Tell us why. Or why not? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Earlier, I mentioned reports that former NFL player Aaron Hernandez is the youngest athlete who's been found to have this degenerative brain disease, CTE. There are questions whether the damage to his brain impacted the choices he made while living. Do high-profile cases like this make you question the safety of the sport at the local high school or college level or in the NFL? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Linda McHale is with us from WUSF Studios in Tampa. Her late husband, Tom McHale, was a former lineman and the sixth former NFL player to be diagnosed with CTE. What do researchers know about this disease to date? Joining me in studio now is Dr. David Wong, Director of Sports Medicine at Quinnipiac University, Clinical Director of Elite Sports Medicine at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. He also serves on the Board of Directors for the Brain Injury Alliance of Connecticut. It's BIAC. Dr. Wong, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, thank you.
So I've been trying to make sure I don't trip up saying chronic traumatic encephalopathy or CTE. Tell us what this is.
Well, as you've already noted, it's a neurodegenerative disease. Causes a progressive loss of function. It's characterized by a protein deposition in the brain called a tau protein. And basically what we believe we know is that it's a result of cumulative trauma to the head.
When you mention this protein, I think of when we hear about cases of dementia and Alzheimer's. Is it similar?
Yes, exactly. There are actually many what they're called tauopathies, which are a protein deposition in the brain causing neurodegenerative changes. There are long lists of these. Alzheimer's is the most well-known, but we do certainly now understand that CTE is one of the big ones as well.
When was the first time that, I guess, researchers, doctors started talking about CTE? And in the beginning, there's a lot of attention on do concussions cause this, but the science has developed since then. And what are the causes behind it?
Yes, it has. I mean, honestly, you can go back into the early 1900s with boxers and dementia pugilistica, which was described way back then as the beginning of us understanding this. It was quiet for a while, but then it sort of resurfaced again as we started to talk about football. And you rightly point out something that I've had to deal with a lot, which is that concussions and CTE are spoken in the same sentence too often. And in fact, with the movie that came out, which is a really good movie about Dr. Malu and CTE, they named it concussions. And so I see all these children with concussions, and of course the parents' natural thought is, oh my gosh, is this CTE? And I do still want to clarify that these are different entities. Concussion is a transient neurologic deficit. CTE is a result of cumulative trauma, with or without concussions. At least that's my belief at this time.
We heard from Lisa McHale earlier during her husband's 9-year career within the NFL. She never knew if he'd had a concussion, but he was an offensive lineman. So we're talking about repetitive hitting over and over and over.
You're absolutely right. The line, every play is a blow for a lineman. And, you know, the other players, you know, you see the hits, you see the collisions, but they're not every play. But in an offensive lineman, it's almost every play.
And when you mention boxing, boxers, are they more likely to develop CTE than a pro football player from what we know?
Well, that's a great question as well. We don't have all the science to answer this. In fact, to be honest with you, we're just learning. So we don't know more than we know. So with regards to boxers, do we see cases of, or have there been documented cases of CTE? I believe there have. It's not to the same numbers as football players, but nor are there the same number of boxers. And boxers are also vulnerable to the traumatic brain injury, the bleeds and the things like that that cause, that are catastrophic. So do we see it? Yes. Old retired boxers with Parkinsonian characteristics and things like that. For sure. Do we know what the incidence is? No. We just know that we see a lot of them.
You mentioned old boxers, Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For sure.
Hockey players.
Yep. And, the hysteria, so to speak, and again, it's rightly so that we're talking about this because it's important. But we also want people to keep the perspective because there is at least a published case of a person who thought they might have CTE, so they did end their own life, and then it was found out afterwards they didn't have it.
Well, you mentioned we can't ignore the number of pro football players. Today we're focusing in on football that have their families donated their brains.
Yeah.
After, I'm just going to read a list. I come from Pittsburgh. Former Steelers like Mike Webster, he physically declined after he died, diagnosed with CTE. Justin Strelzik, an offensive lineman, drove his car the wrong way on the highway, died. He was found to have CTE. Terry Long, offensive lineman, he killed himself by drinking antifreeze and died. He was found to have CTE.
Yes.
Junior Seau didn't play for the Steelers, but he was a talented player, died by suicide, CTE.
Yes, for sure. There's so many cases. I grew up and am raised in Minnesota, and so I'm not a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, but we had several of our players, and most recently Fred McNeil, who were diagnosed with CTE. So it's definitely prevalent. The question that we can't answer is the incidence. In other words, people who donate their brains to the Sports Legacy Institute have concerns, in most cases, or thoughts that there might be CTE, and they find a high level of CTE. But we don't have a denominator. We have a numerator, but we don't have a denominator. But we're working on it. There's some great scientists working on this and finding ways to diagnose it in the living. When we do that, we'll be able to gain a lot more information.
This is Where We Live. In studio with me, Dr. David Wong, Director of Sports Medicine at Quinnipiac University, Clinical Director of Elite Sports Medicine at Connecticut Children's Medical Center. Today we're talking about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. With us from Tampa is Lisa McHale. Her late husband, Tom McHale, played in the NFL. He was the sixth former NFL player to be diagnosed with CTE. Lisa, I'm sure you've been able to hear Dr. Wong walk us through CTE, what we know, what we may not know. I'm just curious what your thoughts are and how we should be moving forward when we're talking about making these sports safer, not only, again, for the pro athletes, but for the kids playing today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I agree so much with everything Dr. Wong has said. And in large part, everything that we know, there's so much more that is unknown. But I will say, having experienced this disease and knowing hundreds of families who have, is that I would caution people against minimizing how devastating this disease is. We don't know the incidence, but we do know now that playing football does present a risk to people. And that's what people need to bear in mind. Even with the NFL players, it is very, very true that the 110 out of 111 brains that was just released in the Journal of the American Medical Association paper is from a heavily biased sample, without a doubt. But it's also the case that finding that many positive cases of CTE among NFL players means that it cannot be rare in that population. And that's scary because it shouldn't exist at all. And so I think every parent needs to think about the implications for kids. There are a lot of indications that the younger they play, the more vulnerable they are to sustaining injury to the brain. It's during a period of very rapid development. And so we need to consider a lot of things as we are thinking about the kinds of activities that we want our kids to engage in.
And you can join the conversation, 2860-275-7266. Have you wrestled with this idea? Should I allow my child to play football or even any other contact sport where you worry about brain injuries, frequent concussions? Although we did hear Dr. Wong say concussions does not mean that you're going to have CTE. There are other factors, including repetitive hits to the head or tackling, when we see that in football. But again, you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I want to ask you, Dr. Wong, when we think about when kids play in elementary school, junior high, high school, you know, when is there a time where they shouldn't be allowed to tackle?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that again we're trying to sort out and actually have an answer that is meaningful other than just arbitrary. But let me say this: taking care of so many children with concussions, they are neurologically immature. The time to heal for the pediatric patient is significantly longer than the adult patient. And with with them being neurologically immature and being more vulnerable, and having more prolonged courses, I think we have to take a cautious approach with our children. Where do we draw this line? Where is neurologic maturity? I mean, honestly, we know that in terms of men, neurologic maturity is somewhere in the 20s, exactly. So thoughts are out there now, and the age 14 has been thrown around. And it makes sense. You know, we don't understand it completely, so let's just, let's be a little bit more protective. But what about 15? What about 13? Don't have those answers yet, but we are doing what we can, or at least the sports organizations are. And one of the things that they're trying to do is limit those exposures. So each organization, each sports is trying to limit exposure, knowing that repetitive blows is the issue. But as for the age, when to draw that line, each organization is looking at it differently. Hockey has different lines that they drew. They change from, peewee to bantam in terms of checking. Soccer has made changes in terms of hitting the ball. So everybody's trying, but it's trying.
And later on, I should say, we are going to hear from a high school coach, and we're going to hear from some parents about some of the questions they have. We're going to hear about initiatives that have been enrolled in recent years at schools to protect children when they play this game. But I'm curious, maybe we can talk a little bit about, we've been focusing on the brains of these deceased players that have been studied. They've been found to have CTE. Are doctors getting any closer to diagnosing this in a living person? Or is there a way to find this?
They're getting closer. Actually, just in the recent month, some new ideas have come out, some of them out of Boston, where the Sports Legacy Foundation is, looking at a cytokine, a type of protein in the blood or serum that might be able to pick up whether someone has CTE. And then there was the PET scan on the Fred McNeil case, a PET scan with a radioisotope injected before that attaches to tau protein to see the pattern of tau protein in the brain. These are, cases of one. But they're promising because this is important. If we can start to diagnose it in the living, then we're really going to have a better grip on this thing.
What would treatment look like if you were able to diagnose it in a living person? Because we know there are still advances trying to be made on how to help people with Alzheimer's.
You're exactly right. I mean, ton of resources has gone into Alzheimer's work, and we still don't have all the answers here. Mm-hmm. So dealing with a degenerative process or a tauopathy, you know, there is certainly research being done, but what the treatment will be, a cure someday, I don't know.
Well, we heard Lisa mention this earlier about we can't ignore the number of former athletes who've died, who've been found to have this, but also the circumstances surrounding their deaths.
As she rightly pointed out, in almost all of these cases, it's usually something traumatic, accidental, depressive, you know, severe depression. And if you look at the brain and where the CTE is, you'll see that it's in the area where decisions and emotions are made. So if you look just at the PET scan from the Fred McNeil case, the midbrain area, the fornix, the hippocampus, these areas which have to do with memory and then the amygdala with emotions, these areas, if impaired, will lead to poor decision-making, driving on the wrong side of the road, drug abuse, alcohol. It would lead to poor decision-making.
What did you think when you heard the news that Aaron Hernandez at 27 had a severe case of CTE?
Well, that was a tough one because here is a man who's a convicted murderer, and now we're saying, and we could say, and we can legitimately say this, he made that decision because of CTE. It wasn't like that before. He didn't, you know, that decision, that was a part of his disease. That's a challenging one. But does it surprise me? No.
Lisa McHale, your reaction to Aaron Hernandez?
Yeah, I got to say, that case for me was very convicting. When I had read about the circumstances of what he was in jail for, I didn't want to believe that CTE could cause that kind of extreme behavior to that extent. And so, but in learning that how advanced his disease was at 27 years of age, I just think there's no question in my mind. As Dr. Wong says, when you understand the areas of the brain affected and you understand the ability of this disease to literally transform our loved ones, it would be unreasonable to suspect that it didn't have something to do with what happened with Aaron.
Lisa, I had touched on this earlier with you, but I wanted to ask you again. I know that you were, I believe you were part of a lawsuit that former NFL players against the NFL. It was settled. What now? When people turn on the tube and they watch the game coming up, what safety guidelines have been put in place to protect these pro athletes who've been playing since they were kids?
Well, I think a lot has been done within the NFL to change rules that will definitely lead to safer play for athletes. Not the least of which was limiting the numbers of allowable full contact practices during the season, and so that will absolutely make a difference. But they have a lot of things in place within the NFL to be able to protect those athletes. And I think, again, the question for parents and what people need to really focus on is how is it trickling down to the college level, the high school level, and the youth level?
Again, your husband passed away at a young age, 45. Do you think it would have helped him if he'd known that he'd had this disease?
I would like to think that it would have been nice for Tom to have known that there was a neurological reason for what he was experiencing, and that he wasn't just failing in being the man that he wanted to be. And I would hope that for those struggling today, that the knowledge of this disease, the fact that we now have a reason for these behaviors, because a lot of the behaviors don't make our loved ones particularly lovable at times, and that it has a name. CTE, now we know what it is, we have a name for it. I'm hoping it diminishes the stigma so that these guys can come forward, they can talk with their families, they can seek help and treatment and support and resources.
Lisa McHale, Director of Family Relations at the Concussion Legacy Foundation. She joined us today from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Again, her husband, Tom McHale, died at 45. He was later to be found his brain to have a severe case of the degenerative brain disease known as CTE. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, despite this attention on this sport and this disease, football's still pretty popular. We're going to talk with parents and a coach after the break and find out what kinds of changes are being made to the sport to make it safer. We'll take your calls, too, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. So how do parents and coaches and schools respond to reports about brain damage in athletes? Do you worry about if your child plays football or hockey or another sport? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. In studio with me, Dr. David Wong, Director of Sports Medicine at Quinnipiac, Clinical Director of Elite Sports Medicine at Connecticut Children's Medical Center in Hartford. He's also on the Board of Directors for the Brain Injury Alliance of Connecticut. And joining us now, Harry Bellucci, Hartford Public Schools Coach, Chairman of Connecticut's Football Coaches Committee. Harry, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be here.
So with increased attention on CTE, talking about head injuries, how has that changed your outlook on the sport? What are your feelings as a coach?
I mean, it's obviously a concerning thing when you see that players at the NFL level going through this. And I would say we have to revisit history. I think a lot of these players that have come up with the CTE have played football in the 80s, 70s, 80s. I played football in the 70s, not to date myself here. But, you know, you were taught to use your head all the time. Put your head in his chest. Nobody teaches football like that anymore. So I think USA Football, which has an incredible heads-up program, over 7,000 youth programs throughout the country now have certified coaches in the heads-up program. So football now is being taught to keep your head out of the play. That wasn't true at all in the 70s or the 80s. Matter of fact, if you did get dinged, what they would call, you know, the protocol back in the 70s and 80s was shake it off. Mm-hmm. Shake it off, get back in the game, little smelling salts. Never occurs today.
When did heads up start?
Heads up started, I believe, 10, 11 years ago. I'm not quite sure of the date, but it's a program that's used now in Connecticut by all high school coaches for a long time. And I think the next generation of NFL players, you'll see a huge difference in that. You will not see heads being used. And I watch NFL every week. And I still see them using their heads, and I don't understand.
And these are big guys.
and world-class athletes. And I'm a little perplexed how they're still using their head during a game. I mean, we all saw Monday night that horrifying scene, and that's a perfect example. He went in with his head and ducked it, which is really bad football. But I'm just shocked at that level they still do it. In my team, if I saw a young man put his head down like that, he'd be out of the game and on the sidelines and say, we're not going to play you if you don't follow the rules that we set for football.
I wanted to ask, Harry, how young is too young to start playing?
Well, that's a good question. My brother-in-law, who Eric Mangini, who was a head coach for the New York Jets and the Cleveland Browns, has three sons, and they all, of course, love football, and they all want to play. And the first one is playing now and is in junior high. He believes that you should start playing contact football in junior high. Before that, his two younger sons have played flag football, which teaches you the basic skills without, obviously, the contact. So I think that's a pretty good denominator, that playing beginning in junior high, 13, 14 years old, in a heads-up program is probably the best way to go.
I wanted to bring in a couple of parents into the conversation now. Joining us by phone is Dr. Keith Penny. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Charlotte Hungerford Hospital in Torrington, also a football team physician, and three of his sons all play football. Dr. Penny, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So as a parent of children who play sports, especially football, you know, what's your take on how the sport has changed?
Well, I sort of have a unique opportunity or view on this issue, since I played football myself. As you mentioned, I have three sons who have played football, one currently at the college level at Wesleyan University, but I'm also a team physician here locally for two local high schools. So I sort of see the issue from all sides. As a parent, that's a different situation. You know, I can appreciate what you know, it has been said. Certainly, my wife and I have had some long conversations about whether or not to let our kids play. But to me, it's a question of relative risk. I see all the things that have been done to make the game safer. And to me, we're certainly moving in the right direction. Is it ever going to be completely safe? Probably not. Any contact sport is going to have some relative risk involved. And you just have to assess, as a parent, what you're willing to accept and move forward with.
Coach Bellucci, are players more likely to get hurt in practice versus a game?
Well, now in Connecticut, we have a very strict rule about the number of minutes that you can hit in practice per week. Most coaches don't even use those minutes. Squads are pretty small, 30 to 40 kids, and you can't afford to lose kids in in practice. Probably you get more ankle sprains or, you know, stingers in their shoulders as opposed to concussions, because there's not a lot of contact like that, and you're not really flying around as hard as you do in the game. So as far as maybe a concussion, I would say that happens mostly in a game situation.
And in terms of concussions, we know kids get them. What kind of training do the coaches and other people on the field have to make sure that if a kid is in a rough hit, that you're not sending him back out?
Well, Connecticut coaches probably are at the forefront in the country as far as training. Every high school coach, whether you're a head coach or an assistant coach, has to take a course that is run by the CIAC for concussion training, and that has to be updated every single year. Every practice and every game has a trainer who is, you know, if you think the kid has been dinged, or if they see that, we take him out, and then he goes through the concussion protocol. Mm-hmm. So in Connecticut, for instance, we did the Rio report, which is if a kid gets a concussion, and I'm sure a doctor knows about this, they have to file it into this system. Now, the national average was 6.2 per thousand. In the last 2 years, Connecticut was at 4.2, and then the previous year, 3.9. So that tells you in Connecticut they're doing an outstanding job. The coaches are in Connecticut are. We're being smart, and we're making sure that this doesn't occur. I know in the last 2 years, two seasons, I've had four concussions, three mild ones and one pretty severe one. So I think you're keeping our head out of the game and really focusing on that is making a huge difference in Connecticut.
I'm going to bring another parent into the conversation. Before I do that, though, for, you know, kids love to, you know, when they're playing, they love to play. Any concern that a child or, you know, a young man will say, that a teenager will say, well, I'm not hurt, coach, put me back in?
Well, if I see that collision and I hear that collision, it doesn't matter to me what he says. He's taking his helmet off and he's getting evaluated right then and there. I'm a father of three daughters, and everybody always says to me, would you let your daughters play football? Well, I in fact did let my daughter play football at a Hall High School, and it was a great experience for her. So, yes, I would.
Catherine Snedeker is executive director of Pink Concussions. She's a mother of three sons. Catherine, you're not a supporter of football. Tell us why.
It's a pretty broad statement, but I am just listening to the show. You know, the NFL is going to be very pleased because it sounds like everybody, hook, line, and sinker, has really sucked up their marketing program, Heads Up Football. And if you actually read the one research study by Zach Keir on Heads Up Football, which I haven't gone through with Zach. I also was in the congressional hearing where the NFL had USA Football lied to Congress about the results of that. The American public has been given a marketing plan by the NFL called Heads Up Football about reducing concussions. That's just upsetting to me because parents don't know the real risk. And I was in the NFL headquarter offices when this marketing plan was created, and then research was added later, which didn't support its beliefs. So, no, I would not let my children play based on the research that I've read, which very few people have actually read, and is suppressed most of the time. Have my sons had concussions? Yes, in lacrosse, in life, in recess. Concussions happen in all sorts of places, so I don't think you can protect them, but I think the true risk of playing tackle football under the age of 14 has been suppressed, and parents don't know the risks.
Dr. Penny, I wanted to ask you to respond to Catherine's concerns about parents not knowing the risks of football.
Well, I actually agree in the sense that we don't know the long-term ramifications of youth sports through high school and then the sequelae down the road. This honestly is in sort of a burgeoning area of research. As Dr. Wong had stated, we know very little, to be honest. I think we have made great strides. I think the incidents are all down across the board at all levels. But determine when it's safe to play, if it's safe to play at all, ultimately, is certainly a big question mark. And just knowing that is sort of a difficult thing that I think all the parents have to deal with on a personal basis.
It's actually, if you look back in history, you can see every 20 years a burgeoning of parents that are concerned about their youth playing football. And I was just reading a 1960s article in Parents Magazine where the American Academy of Medicine was, and at that time too, the American Academy of Pediatrics, all believed that football should be prohibited under the age of 12. So we actually were making strides further in the 60s until I believe that money got involved. I mean, if you go to a pediatric brain injury conference and you ask these doctors off record if children should play football, they say no. You put a microphone in their hand, and the NFL has so much money in not one person's research, but another academy's research, another institution's research. Nobody can go on. No doctor can go on and really talk about the truth about youth football. And
again, I want to get the coach to respond to you, Catherine. Coach Harry Belucci, Harvard Public Schools coach and chairman of Connecticut's Football Coaches Committee. What do you think of what Catherine's saying?
You know, I think Catherine has some valid points. I don't think it's necessary for kids 6, 7, 8, and 9 years old to be playing tackle football. There are a lot of skills to learn when you're playing football that don't require tackling. Like I said, I think a kid starting football at 12, 13, 14 years old is fine. The fact of the matter is, you know, in high school football, after 4 years of playing, 6% of those kids go on to play college football. And probably even a smaller number of them have even finished their careers in college football. And I know there's a concern, but at a place where I work at Hartford Public High School, and I've been a head coach since 2004 there, but I've been a high school football coach for 38 years. From 2004 to last year, between football scholarships and academic scholarships, Hartford High football players have received $2.7 million in scholarships, and this is due to football. And these are opportunities that where I work at Hartford Public High School, these kids need, and it changes lives. There is risk. Of course there is risk. There's risk in taking a family ski trip and going down Black Diamond at Stowe. You know, there's risks everywhere. I know Lisa has an initiative on her website about girls soccer and heading and how they're trying to take it out of girls soccer, and my daughters played soccer, and that always worried me. So there are risks in everything.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank Harry Belucci, Hartford Public Schools coach. Also, Catherine Snedeker, thank you for joining us, Executive Director of Pink Concussions, and Dr. Keith Penny, Orthopedic Surgeon at Charlotte Hungerford Hospital in Torrington. Dr. David Wong, we thank you, too, for your expertise. Time is short, but we appreciate your time. We got a couple listeners wondering about CTE and rugby, so we'll try to revisit this conversation in the future. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.